Join the conversation at everydaynovelist.com. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find the host at J.D. Sawyer on Minds.com, or hit him up at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.
Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life.
So, after inducing me to spend about an hour talking about the dynamics of historiography, Ed has given us a follow-up suggestion for a whole series. And since we're trying to fill a little bit of time between now and the start of the...
Nano Gangbang?
The name stuck, what can I say? Just get all sticky. Anyway.
We're just dirty-minded over here.
Not just dirty-minded. Okay. We're dirty-minded plus. Dirty-minded plus intelligence and erudition. That's how we get away with it. Okay.
Dirty-minded and creative.
Or at least we like to think so. All right. So Ed has sent in a fantastic suggestion for a series called Going Pro. Kitty is going to read you the basic premise and then the question for episode one.
So, you work on craft as a hobbyist for a while, and then, at some point, you decide to go pro. In the old days, you'd just keep submitting
I'm sorry. You work on craft as a hobbyist, and then at some point, you decide to make nachos out of it. Sorry. Craft cheese. Sorry. We are literally recording this out in the middle of the wilderness, and we've already started to play banjos. Ding, 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 and I'm off key. Ding, 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 ding. There we go. I'm on key.
If Dan is not careful, I am going to throw him in the lake outside.
I'm always careful.
Mm-hmm, sure. In the old days, you'd just keep submitting to traditional publishers until one bought your rights. However, that's no longer the only path, and we also know how much that traditional path is just dumb luck. So, if you want to go pro as an indie or hybrid author, what do you need to do?
Well, for the... And I'm going to get this out of the way because the whole rest of the series is about the indie stuff. But for the hybrid part of it, you do need to be submitting to pro markets. You just want to decide how you're going to use them in order to create visibility for your indie career. For some authors, this has worked really well. I don't know if this will work well now because the industry has changed since these authors got into it, as it changed a lot over the last 5 or 6 years, but M.L. Buckman and Gail Carriger are both excellent examples of people who used the traditional publishing world to leverage up an indie career that's doing quite well.
What level does your craft need to be before jumping from hobbyist to pro? How do you know it's there? There's no rigid gatekeeper anymore.
Okay, so that's the basic series premise, and now we've got 7 episodes where we're going to get into aspects of it that Ed has kindly laid out for us. Episode 1, which is today,
Actually, the craft starts with that question.
Oh, that's the question. So that's today's question.
But it's a little bit longer.
Okay, so continue reading the rest of today's question.
If you go indie, is it a problem if you release your early stories that may not... If you go indie, is it a problem if you release your early stories that may not be that great? If later you come back and spot their flaws, do you leave them up or take them down? They might not be up to your later standards, but they can still make money and they give you a deeper catalog. On the other hand, anyone finding them first might go, meh.
So, there's no problem with putting up your early stuff on the catalog as long as it's well-published and well-labeled. I don't mean labeling it, warning, this was Dan Sawyer's early story and has been known to make grown roaches cry in disgust at the bad grammar. Nothing like that. What I mean is that you don't really have to worry about meh. Meh is meh. It's almost a non-reaction. You're just bouncing off their armor. You're creating a lack of interest. Lack of interest is not a problem. Strong feelings of betrayal and anger are. Someone that you didn't pick up through lack of interest today, you may pick up again and keep a year or two from now, because they'll basically have forgotten about you. And if another book of yours catches their eye and your craft is better, they're not even going to associate you with that other thing until they see it on an also buy list.
No reader remembers the names of authors that they didn't bother to read.
Or that they didn't care about.
Yeah. There have been a lot of short stories I've read in anthologies, and I don't remember the names of the authors of the good ones.
Yep.
Let alone the ones that I thought were boring as hell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually will occasionally go back to those anthologies and look at the stories that I liked when I'm wanting a new book that's got a certain flavor and I remember that story. But I do have to go back to the anthologies and look. Now, obviously, this isn't going to be the case for people with an eidetic memory or with that brain malfunction that allows them literally to record everything like a court reporter. But for everybody else, this is the way it works. Meh is not something you need to worry about. Go ahead and put them up with good descriptions, good metadata. Now, that's assuming that they are not the kind of stories that will make someone throw the book across the room, then set their house on fire because they can't believe they deigned to share it with such an awful tome. And there's really only two ways you can get a reaction like that. The first is to have subject matter or a treatment of subject matter that offends someone personally, and you can't control for that. So the only time this would be an issue when putting up your early stories versus your later ones is if your focus as a writer changes so much that those early stories cover territory that you don't cover later on, or that is so far out of what you cover later on that that you risk turning a reader off for the wrong reason.
A good example of this is we know more than one author who writes in a particular genre, say science fiction adventure or something like that. And their early short stories, they have a lot of horror or maybe some erotica. They don't leave those published
Not
under the same name. Yep. They may keep them up under a pen name or relist them under a pen name, but they don't allow something that is such a different genre to exist in the same pen name.
Or they will collect them as the erotica stories of blah, or the horror stories of blah, and in the foreword they will explain this is not the normal genre, but. But those, yeah, so that there's that you want to worry about. And then the other thing is, if the story is really bad, and I mean really actually genuinely bad, like betrays the audience expectations that you set up bad, those are the stories you may want to consider not putting up, or only putting up in an anthology that has a preface to the story saying, this is one of my early stories, I'm not necessarily proud of it, but for those completionists out there, I'm including it.
Right.
But you wouldn't necessarily want to leave it on its own in the wild with your name on it. These are the stories that don't fulfill the promises that they've set up, that deliberately betray reader trust, that... Okay, sorry. I'm having to deliberately avoid mentioning authors that have done this to me. that deliberately betray reader trust, or that have so little of a good sense of what they are that they switch genres in the middle without having it be a masterful move. Right? So if something starts life as erotica and then ends as torture porn, and that switch comes right at the point where you expect the reader to be having their first orgasm, that, you know, they won't like that. They get mad.
Unless they have a really weird kink.
Yeah, they make fake snuff films for people like that. Those are the kind of things you want to look out for in putting those early stories up. But if the early stories are not that, if it's just an issue of I'm just not that good yet, it might leave readers, meh, I don't think you need to worry about it. Now let's get back to the early part of the question where he asked about craft levels. Refresh our memory on what he said.
What level does your craft need to be before jumping from hobbyist to pro? How do you know it's there? How do you know it's ready to go pro?
Now, I'm going to do something that you're going to hate me for. I'm going to make you answer this because you're the editor. And I'm an author. Okay, so the reason I'm doing this is that she's, not just that she's the editor, but that my opinions on this subject are crap. And I mean that they're rather serrated, they're rather nasty, and they're informed by a lot of resentment that I have towards certain authors and have accumulated over the years. So it's not just that I'm an author and I have a vested interest, though that's a problem too. So, someone who is a professional audience member, Kitty, how do you know when it's ready?
Are you writing stories that are complete, like they have an actual ending? Are you writing stories that are coherent, that make sense to readers of the genre that you think it is? If you put it away for 2 months and you read it, does it make sense?
Are you embarrassed about it for reasons other than it shows parts of you that you don't normally show in public?
Yeah. People's tastes vary all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So what my...
I just basically burned a book by a good friend yesterday. I was really offended by it, not because of the subject matter, but because of the style of the storytelling. It so bored me that I felt like I was being insulted, but that's because I, as a reader, have really particular tastes.
And it was a style thing. I read it, and I could see where it was going and was like, it's this genre, and you hardly ever read that genre.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of what you consider good or bad is going to be a matter of taste. Some things that... You'll have things that annoy you to death that doesn't bother anyone else, and it's just a particular taste. So really, does the story make sense if you put it away? Does the story make sense to a first reader that's honest with you and reads in the genre that you write? Because never ask me if a romance makes sense, if a category romance makes sense.
Weirdly, I'm a better romance reader than you are, and I don't particularly like the genre. But for you, the genre actually offends you. And for me, it's just less interesting than the other genres.
Right. And for me, the reason romance doesn't generally appeal to me is I have to be emotionally invested in the characters to care that they are having a romance, and the meeting and the opening developments of a romance are much less interesting to me than a romantic relationship that may be long-lasting and ongoing, or that, mm-hmm. you know, Dan teases me because I really enjoy romantic elements in long-running television shows, but I will never read a category romance. And it's like, well, after 2 years of solving stupid mysteries, I care about these characters and I want them to fall in love. Mm-hmm. But if you start out with the whole point is them
just
falling in love,
cute, yeah.
I'm like bored.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's go through it then step by step so we develop something of a checklist. The first thing is the writing needs to be intelligible. You have to have a good enough command, and this is actually a little more difficult than most people think. You have to have a good enough command vocabulary that your words mean what you think they mean, and that you're choosing words that are specific instead of ambiguous. Spoken American English in the current day is full of lots of ambiguous words, general words, words like thing and stuff. And these are good words, but beginning writers tend to overuse general words and expect that their readers will understand what they had in mind. by the context. And the problem is that there is a way to do this, but it actually takes an advanced grandmaster level writing craft to pull it off. It's a very, very rarefied art to write prose that appears to have little semantic content, yet draws a very particular picture. But it reads the way that people talk. And so it feels like it should be easy to do. It's not. It's really, really hard. So as a beginning writer, the first stage in making sure your craft works is checking to make sure your sentences say what you think they do. That you're using the words that you mean to use. Not that you were thinking of at the time you wrote it, but that will paint the picture in the mind of your audience that you want them to have painted. You want your audience to receive the signal you're sending on a sentence-by-sentence level. That's step one. Would you agree?
Yeah. Yes.
They can't hear you nodding your head, that's why.
Yes.
If I was nodding my head, they could hear the rattling. But so number two. And that, by the way, number one, that's not proofreading, that's craft. Proofreading, I'm assuming that you're going to proofread the book before you put it up. Number two is you want to make sure that the information flow in the story is decent. It doesn't have to be perfect, but it has to be decent. Your audience needs to receive the information in such an order that they can make sense of what's going on. This is true on a plot level, it's true on a description level, and it's true on a conversational level. Especially true on an action level.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you'll see done in films a lot that people try to imitate in books when they're young writers is the action will precede the rationale. Cold opens on television series are like this sometimes. They'll open with this major action chase scene and you'll see a familiar face or something, or maybe not, and it'll wrap up with a dramatic standoff, and then you'll get a title card that says 3 days earlier. And you'll lead up to that section.
One thing you'll notice is that you never have that in the first... You almost never have that in the first season of a television show.
Well, it never works. And people do it, but it never works.
But the thing is, when you do it in a TV show, you do it after you have established the characters, the plot devices, the system that they have for solving the mystery of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
And then you break it to maintain interest. Your first novel is not going to be in the middle of a TV series.
No. And even if it's a novel... So I did this with In the Cloud, which is number 6 of the Clark Latham Mysteries. And I did it specifically because I wanted to see how one would have to do things in order to make it work in a book.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that most of the people picking it up would be returning to Latham, so they would know him. But because it's a book, you can't really count on that, because you always get the risk that you're going to be getting new readers. And so the first chapter of the book is in media res, which is in the middle of the action, but it's not opening with an explosion or something like that, like you would see on TV. It's Latham in a hidey hole while he's being hunted. And then he goes back to what brought him to this point, and we meet up in the middle. But that's the kind of way you can do it in a book. You can start with your main character in great jeopardy and then recap how they got there. But you can't open it just on solid action and have it work. And the reason is the action itself... The literal violence, the chasing, the running, the movement, none of that makes sense to the reader if they don't have a context.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can't connect cause to effect. When you're on film, you know, explosions are beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And noise is exciting. When it's on the page, it's not. Unless you establish the context in which the action is providing movement.
And that's one of the things that I was trying to get at as well with even in television, this only works in later seasons.
Mm-hmm.
It's you have a context when it's an established series, but you do not have that context in a necessarily in a film or early on in this in the series.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly true. So information flow at all levels needs to be good enough to be easily intelligible. And if you're going to deliberately screw up the information flow in order to make life difficult for your reader, you have to be giving them something else that makes them stick through. And it's not as easy to do that as it used to be. Because it used to be, you know, 50, 60 years ago, you give them a little bit of sexual titillation and they'd come along for anything. Because it was hard to get that in books that you didn't buy in brown paper bags under the counter somewhere.
Mm.
But now we've got the internet. Everybody is always constantly titillated to the point of boredom. So that doesn't work anymore. You have to give them something else that's, you know, really solid characterization or some other reason for them to stick through a jumbled information flow, a non-linear type of story.
Mm-hmm.
But that aside, you really want to make sure your information flow is solid at all levels. So we got that. The next level after that will be the plot. Plot needs to make sense. The motivations of the characters need to become clear in the telling of the story. Hopefully not through a Bond villain speech at the end, though sometimes that can work. You need to know, the reader needs to know why things happen in your book. They don't need to know everything all at once. You know, you reveal it progressively through the story, but you'd better know why things are happening in your book, at least as well as your point of view character does in the scene you're telling. If you know more than that, that's great, as long as you don't telegraph the wrong things. But that's more of a high-level thing. We're talking basic competence. You need to know why your protagonist is acting at least as well as they do. And your readers need to understand it, too.
Yeah. One way you can figure this out is when you have your first reader read it, maybe give them not the entire book, but give them like all but the last act, however long that is, and then ask them what they think is going to happen next.
That's a really good technique, actually. Yeah.
And if it's reasonably close, and they're readers of the genre that you're in, then you know that you are at least on the right page.
Mm-hmm.
That your ending makes sense to readers who have read your beginning.
Yep. That's a very, very good one. Along those lines, should also, the next level is genre expectations and archetypal expectations. And these are not the same, but they're very closely related, so we'll do them at the same time. Your genre, commercial fiction of all sorts, is defined by the expectations that the readers bring to the books. They expect a certain kind of story when they show up for the mystery. If you give them a mystery in which there is a lost locket that must be found, and then the characters get bogged down in trying to sort out someone's marital difficulties and they forget all about the locket at the end, you don't have a mystery. You have a comedy or theater of the absurd. In fact, what was it? Greg Taylor did almost exactly this thing in, I wish I could remember the name of the episode, an episode of Blackjack Justice, Dakota Ring Theater.
Uh-huh.
And at the beginning of the episode, one of the characters says to the other, "This isn't going to be one of those times, is it?" "What?" "You know, one of those times where we get sidetracked, put a lot of work in, and we completely forget what we were going out to find out in the first place." And he's like, "Oh, one of those times. Yeah, no, we won't do that." And then you get to the end of the episode, and their client calls asking for the answer to the background check she had them running or something. And they realize that they had completely forgotten about it because the ensuing adventure took them off in a completely different direction. I think their informant got kidnapped or something.
Yeah.
You can do that, but it's a way to subvert the formula. But in Greg's case, he subverted it by giving us another mystery to follow, so it's still a mystery. Mm-hmm. If you subvert it and you don't give another mystery to follow, it's not a mystery anymore. And your audience is going to be pissed. You can't package it as a mystery. And you can't, your opening pages cannot make your readers expect to be dealt fairly with in a mystery. They should make the readers expect that whatever happens, they're going to be fucked with. And if they stick around through that, then that's fine. But you need to fulfill your genre expectations, which means you need to know them. Mm-hmm.
You can write any genre. You can start out writing one genre and end up writing another. Mm-hmm. When you're an early writer, you are going to do this.
Yep.
What's most important is that when you look back at your story, you identify the genre that it ended up being.
And market it as that.
And market it correctly.
Yep.
And you maybe have to fix it a little bit because you end up writing something different than you started writing. And that's another thing that's the editing process. But you have to be able to tell what genre you end up with when you decide to sell it.
Yeah, because if you market it incorrectly, as I said to Gail during our 1,000th episode celebration, if you have the best story in the world that's packaged incorrectly, it's like going to a bar and buying a $20 shot of scotch and receiving a $100 shot of gin. It doesn't matter how good the gin is. It's not what you came there for. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to be pissed.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to do that to your readers. Now, along those same lines, there's the archetypal expectations. And those are, in the most basic sense, though these are not the only two, the hero's journey and the heroine's journey. Your storytelling will lead the audience to expect one character arc or the other. And you need to make sure that you prime them to expect the ending that you give them. This is also true with comedy and tragedy, with travesty, etc. You need to prime them to expect the outcome that they get. They don't have to be able to predict it, but they do have to expect it. So if you give them the story of Perseus, exiled as a child, returned to rescue Andromeda, and then at the very end of the story, it's not Perseus that rescues Andromeda at all. Andromeda slips the lock on her own and decks the Kraken before Perseus can get there, your audience is going to be pissed. Or if on the verge of doing it, Perseus gets slaughtered and Pegasus winds up going over and like eating the chains off Andromeda and freeing her from the rock, that's not going to work either. If you have a hero, the hero must affect the final heroic act either by conquering or by sacrificing himself in such a way that makes the final heroic act successful. Or by failing in such a way that it's deeply tragic.
Mm.
But you can't have it subverted at the end there, or people get pissed. Similarly, if you have a heroine, she can't wind up alone at the end. The hero can wind up alone. The heroine winds up standing with at least her lover, if not her family.
And
friends at the end of the story.
When we're talking about hero and heroine, we're talking about the story type, the story archetype. We're not necessarily talking about the gender of the main character.
Right.
A male character can have a heroine's journey. A female character can have a hero's journey.
Yep.
It's
and the same character can have different journeys throughout the course of a series.
Yes.
Suavrob 1, hero's journey. Suavrob 2, halfway between a hero's journey and a heroine's journey.
And Suavrob 3 was a heroine's journey. And these are called hero's journey and heroine's journeys because these were the archetypes of the male and female life
in the ancient world.
In the ancient world. And, you know, some of those things don't matter in the modern world. The story arcs are still relevant, but they're not necessarily gender specific.
I don't mean to cut you off, but it's also worth pointing out that in the ancient world they got mixed up too. There are myths about, especially female gods, mm-hmm. that follow the hero's journey. And there are usually comedies featuring male protagonists that are heroines' journeys. Mm-hmm. Apuleius is the golden ass, leaps to mind. Mm-hmm. So they did mix it up in the ancient world as well, at least once the stories moved out of the religious context.
Yes.
So, anyway, please continue.
Kind of where I was ending.
Okay, so you want to make sure your expectations are good. If you've got those four things, your language command, your information flow, your genre expectations, and your archetypal expectations, if those things all work, you're good to go. And you don't even have to be really good at any of them, and you're still going to be ahead of most people in the field, including a lot of professionals who have been selling very well.
That is true.
So, the other thing that I would make sure before I went pro on a craft level, don't just watch TV. And don't just watch recent movies. Watch older films, read older books. A lot of writing advice tells you just read what's popular right now. Find the books that you like among the bestsellers and read those, because that tells you how to hit the market right now and hit reader tastes. That's not terrible advice, except for the just.
You need both.
You need both. It's good to keep your pulse on what's going on now, but if you don't have the cultural depth to pull from, the best you can hope for is to write something that will divert someone's attention for 2 hours that they might like enough to tell a friend. Your odds of hitting a deep cultural vein and riding the zeitgeist in a huge way are way lower, and your odds of having longevity are basically zero if you're not tapping into the deeper stuff that stretches back into history.
If you want to be rereadable or rewatchable or whatever, if you want
rereadable, yeah.
If you want to be something that is picked up over and over again,
and that's passed down to children,
then you want to be connecting to the whole of your cultural tradition. Yes. You don't want to just be in the moment.
Yes, that's exactly where I was headed. So I think that covers craft pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
So that's episode one. Next time, what are we talking about?
Output.
All right, so next time we're going to be talking about output and productivity. So thank you very much, Ed, for the idea for this series, and we'll see the rest of you tomorrow, and we'll see you then.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty Nakian, and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer, and the production is copyright 2019 Artistic Whispers Productions, Incorporated. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license, and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners. Join the conversation. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find me at jdsawyeronminds.com or hit me at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.